from. It is August 6, 2010. We were at the offices of the OCC in Washington, D.C. for interviewing Mr. Dugan. Mr. Dugan, thank you very much for taking time to talk to us today. My name is Chris Seifer. This is Bruce McWilliams. We're with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. We were, as you probably know, since you've testified before our commission, established by a statute last year called the Fraud Enforcement and Recovery Act that tasks us with figuring out the various causes of the financial crisis by the end of this year. That statute tells us to look at several things, including one, the issue of too big to fail, and two, tells us to look at any institution that failed or would have failed but for the receipt of government assistance. Wachovia sort of falls into both of those categories, at least in the first instance. The FDIC approved the systemic risk exception to FDICA for that institution, but of course, ultimately, Wells Fargo came in with an unassisted bid. So what I'm primarily interested in talking to you about today is, you know, one, the OCC's, how the OCC goes about identifying and supervising systemically important institutions, and then two, focusing on your knowledge of Wachovia in general, and really specifically the events of that week with WaMu failing, and then the weekend where the systemic risk exception was invoked. So, I guess my first question to you would be.
Before I begin.
Sure.
I just want to make sure that you've been getting the cooperation you need. We've made that a priority in our prior dealings with the FCIC, and I know you've been talking to a number of people. I hope that's the case. If it's not, I'd certainly like to hear about it. But if you have further questions, I hope you'll feel free to ask that as well.
Okay, great. And yes, as I've told Linda, and maybe not Rick, but yes, very good cooperation.
Okay,
and we very much appreciate it. Good on getting documents, good on getting access to people, as you're a perfect example.
Okay.
So on that score, perhaps you could sort of generally tell us how the OCC goes about identifying and supervising systemically important institutions, and if there are any differences with how it supervises non-systemically important institutions.
Yeah, I don't think we make that distinction explicitly. That is to say, we the OCC have always had a program that recognized that the issues, supervisory matters, problems of larger and more complicated institutions requires a different kind of supervision than what we provide to community banks and even mid-sized companies. So for quite a long time, we've had a model that has separated larger institutions. We call it our large bank supervision department or division. And we have a whole separate way that we, different model for doing that. Namely, instead of the examiner on circuit coming by periodically but not continually at smaller banks, we have deliberately adopted a paradigm of having many more examiners. Primary way we do our job is to have on-site examiners doing continuous on-site supervision in our largest institutions, and we have many more expert specialized examiners that are part of those teams and are organized separately to share information on common issues to those larger institutions and, as I said, to specialize in some of the more complicated issues. That model was in place before I got here. It was much larger when I got here. I think we had 22 or 23 institutions involved. Over time, I have tried to make it smaller to focus more on the very largest institutions. So now it's roughly, I guess it's 15 institutions now with 10 domestic institutions and 5 foreign institutions. And I mention the foreign institutions because some of them are smaller than we would normally do domestically, but because they are part of larger foreign operations, they raise some similar issues with respect to things like having to comply with Basel Advanced Approach Capital requirements, and so we group them in the same spot. So that's how we've come about, how we do it, and why we've done it that way. I think it is, that's not necessarily the same thing as identifying someone as systemically significant for purposes of, you know, Fiducia, and now the new resolution and regime adopted in financial reform.
Okay. And then, of course, we know that, you know, the OCC is looking at the insured institution,
right,
but not the holding company.
Correct. It
is for the large institution group or the large bank division. Is there any type of formal relationship with the Federal Reserve that is looking at the holding companies?
There is. We both formal and informal. We do have a memorandum of understanding, I believe, that we've operated on with them for a number of years, and informally, we share all sorts of information with them and meet with them regularly for all the institutions that we supervise. In many cases, they're equivalent to our, they have moved over the years to have on-site examiners become a more significant presence. It's not the total paradigm as it is for us, but in, I think, all of our largest institutions, they have people on site, including what they call their CPC, which is their central point of contact. So a little difference from our examiner in charge, but it's a place where that means that our key people are rubbing shoulders with their people all the time. And then we have meetings regularly of more senior people who have responsibility for a portfolio of larger institutions with their counterparts at the Federal Reserve Board, and often with the key people from the reserve banks that work more directly on the supervision of those holding companies. So that's point one. Point two is, in many cases, particularly the smaller of the largest banks, the bank is by far the biggest asset in the holding company. So, you know, it can be well over 90% of the assets, sometimes even as high as 98%. And so much of what we do is, you know, not so different than Red Bull, that the Fed does.
Okay. Now, I know from looking at the documents for Wachovia, for example, you know, I see an August 4th transmittal of an exam report by the OCC. There's like a July 22nd downgrade letter from the Federal Reserve, which I don't know that they were on site at the same time doing joint exams, but are there joint exams being done with the OCC and the Fed? Or is it
there might be on certain things, but my impression, my understanding is usually we do ours and they do theirs, but they're very coordinated.
Right.
Messages are coordinated. Anything like a document or enforcement action is coordinated. Often we won't go until they're ready to go with theirs and vice versa. And so there's quite robust lines of communication between us and them whenever we do anything like that.
Okay. So let me ask you something a little different. One of the things we've noticed in sort of doing our research on institutions, on banks that have received government assistance in the past, in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, is you sort of see the Continental Illinois and folks like that. The pattern always or appears to be pretty much the same. You know, rapid growth, fairly highly leveraged growth, short-term funding sources, and investment into the relatively riskier long-term assets. And then, of course, they get in trouble and it tends to spark a liquidity run, and the government comes in because they determine that the institution is systemically important. It's going to have an impact on too many other institutions, on the banking system in general, and on the economy in general. And we've seen that with Continental Illinois and other institutions in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And yet, we're a free market capitalist economy. But we then see in the decade of the 2000s, you know, whether it's investment banks or commercial banks or thrifts, that not only that same pattern, but on a much larger scale. You know, now we're not talking about institutions that are $50 billion or $100 billion, but institutions like, for example, Wachovia, that's $800 billion, you know, the investment banks, to $1 trillion. And so one of the things we've been asking folks in the regulatory arena is, how do you deal with that, knowing that history and knowing that, you know, God forbid, you know, if any of these large institutions do get into trouble, we're going to be forced to make these determinations about whether or not we bail them out or not. And at the same time, you know, it is a free market economy, and as long as banks are reporting positive earnings and compliance with capital requirements and the regulators aren't saying your asset quality is bad and you need to write down these assets so stop growing, how do you deal with that situation as the OCC? And has it changed whether at any time and in particular since the crisis?
So it's a good question. So to me, when you cut through a lot of the very important issues that surrounded what happened, I mean, and you referred to this briefly in what you were just in your question, the essence of what causes banks to fail is liquidity problems and run risk, and it comes from the basic intermediation function of and credit maturity transformation of having to borrow short and lend longer than short-term runnable deposits. It's not often that it is a solvency failure, but it's certainly still related when banks get into trouble for what are perceived as solvency threatening. Then that can trigger the lack of confidence, which in turn causes the run. And that's the essence of why banks are regulated, why we regulate institutions. And although it is not just a bank thing, I mean, it's, as we learned in the crisis, runs can happen to non-banks and did happen. And in fact, the investment banks that had not deposit funding, but even more short-term, less stable funding that could run quickly proved to be the most vulnerable first in getting the crisis started. And it was only after that really developed into something bigger and it spilled over to the banks that we have something that triggered then crises of confidence in various ones of them as we went down the path. So, you know, in some ways, the essence of regulating financial institutions, particularly banks, still is all about that. How do you maintain confidence? And what do you do before you have distressed situations to prepare for that so that entities maintain confidence in firms even in a crisis? Of course, one of the ways we do that and has been done all along is by having certain governmental involvement that is accepted everywhere and has been since central banking began, which is, you know, the discount window, efforts to protect the payment system, et cetera, and things that are directly aimed at liquidity problems. But sometimes, of course, that's not enough. You get into much more deeper problems that have to be addressed. I think traditionally, different tools have been used to try to keep these institutions that have this problem safer and to instill confidence, including capital requirements, liquidity requirements, activity restrictions. And all of those were in place in varying degrees, but I think we did learn some lessons from the crisis that meant that there were things we could do better, should do better, and that's at the heart of the financial reform. So, interestingly, I mean, it is true that some of these elements were true and were common threads in the crises that you mentioned. Some were different. I mean, I think we did have significantly higher levels of capital coming into this in the way that we defined capital as a result of the crisis of the 80s and 90s when we insisted on higher levels of capital for institutions. And I think that did help. It wasn't enough, as it turned out, but it did help U.S. banks, in the beginning in particular, withstand more of the problems. I think, so that's one element. The second is that the banking system became progressively a smaller part of the economy, and the liquidity that banks and everyone relied on, the financial system relied on, had a lot to do with securitization and things outside the normal banking channels. And no one counted on that essentially drying up overnight. And that was not a condition that had ever happened before, because we don't have as long a history with that market. But it happened this time, and it caused huge consequences across the system, and played right into the whole liquidity kind of issue that we talked about earlier. So liquidity, I think, was one that we really got caught unprepared for, how significant that system-wide dearth of liquidity would be. And that was different from any other crisis that I'm aware of. But it's one we need to learn some lessons about. In terms of capital, it's not just a matter of the amount of capital. There's a quality of capital lesson that we learned. That is to say, there wasn't enough common equity. And when people perceived that common equity was thin, even though Tier 1 capital was high, it wasn't providing enough confidence instilling this confidence to market participants. And as a result, we began to have runs on banks when their stock price was going down. And we'd never had that before. And there's no inherent reason why creditors, if they've got a lot of cushion in front of them, below them, whether it's equity or some other kind of capital, should get panicked when one piece of that stock starts to go down. But they did. And so I think the lesson that a lot of us took away from this is that real common equity and higher amounts of it are critical, not just as a solvency absorbing or solvency addressing problem, but as a way to instill marketplace confidence that truly loss absorbing stuff is there that can be used in a crisis as a buffer against losses. And that is informing all the kind of post-crisis debate over what we do and how we do it. And then, of course, the other thing that was quite different is the whole interplay of financial derivatives, which is partly about the liquidity, but it has also just had partly different kinds of effects on the market that we had not done before. And I'm thinking here about credit default swaps. And what's interesting to me about that is our banks were dealers in a lot of credit default swaps and actually did not fare badly in terms of losses from their dealing activities in those instruments. I think the bigger, more profound impact of credit default swaps was more on how they were used in the marketplace as signalers of problems, and perhaps even misused at times, at least some would claim that, as ways to amplify crises and make things seem worse than they might have been. Which created problems on the confidence side. So that was new too. And getting more transparency in that, I think, is quite a good thing. Of course, the counterparties that these our banks had that were not regulated, that were not dealers, that took one-sided positions in this, I'm thinking now of AIG and monoline insurance companies, created huge systemic risk. Because once things started to go bad, they would, their whole viability got thrown into question much more directly than it would have been the case with the bank, where they had more offsetting positions because they were in the dealing, offsetting business. So those are some of the answers I would give to the question you raised.
So let me ask you about the funding side of the balance sheet. And if the OCC, what the OCC was doing then and now. And this may be more of an instance where the holding, where the bank is not 90 to 98% of the holding company. And that is, of course, like, and looking at Wachovia's financials, of course, you know, when we look at their funding structure, you know, we see the deposits and the FHLB advances
right
on the bank. And then, of course, you've got sort of the wholesale funding, repos, commercial paper, medium-term notes, and that kind of stuff at the holding company.
Right.
And that's usually where the issues arise, you know, when there's going to be any kind of liquidity run or liquidity hit on the bank. And then, you know, as we've seen with several institutions, when that occurs, you know, they show up asking for the 23A exemption so they can push assets into the bank and fund it through FHLB advances or dialing for dollars on the deposit side. What was the OCC doing in that regard in terms of working with the Fed? You know, since the holding company had those short-term funding sources, recognizing that there could be an issue in the 23A waiver request when things got in trouble, or even with the bank, if it wasn't a holding company issue, but if the bank itself was in addition to deposits and FHLB advances.
Are we talking about Wachovia now, or are we talking general?
I'm talking in general, but to the extent you want to talk about Wachovia as an example.
Yeah, mostly time period, any particular time period?
Well, I guess the first I would say pre-crisis. I mean, what were there... you know, examination procedures, you know, supervision policies about funding sources,
sure.
You know, and so
well, I'll give you my understanding, but of course this is a question that's better asked to the line supervisors. But yes, we have liquidity supervision. We, of course, grade, as you know, banks on liquidity as part of the CAMELS rating system.
Right.
There are significant procedures and policies that people look at in order to determine whether their liquidity risk is adequate. So I think pre-crisis, it was under traditional measures. I think that, first of all, you know, insured deposits extremely stable, held up very well, except in the wake of the IndyMac failure, we did have some problems with some troubled institutions starting to lose deposits, which was quite frightening, actually. But except for that, and that tended to be less of a problem for the really big guys like Wachovia. Citi would be a different category on that. That was viewed as pretty stable funding. And, you know, Federal Home Loan Bank, as examiners, we always get a little nervous about that. It's not quite as stable, and while it's governmental, there has always been concern that they could turn tail at the wrong moment if they got concerned about things, and so we don't quite view that the same as deposit funding. But what I was going to say with pre-crisis, the whole system was so liquid, and getting funding in the marketplace was so easy that liquidity was never viewed with the same kind of concern as other kinds of risks at that time until it all went away. And then it was, I mean, to the point where I would say that, you know, many banks were in the situation where they were borrowing money overnight because they were so liquid. You know, they wouldn't hold a lot of excess liquidity because they didn't need to.
Right.
And so when they needed to and they had issues, they would borrow some and fund other things that were going on, have big cash positions, and it wouldn't be done in a really large institution. And that doesn't mean you can't get to that place really quickly. When we thank you. Now, when the crisis started, then our, of course, liquidity concerns, intensity of supervision, everything ramped up dramatically, particularly in the larger institutions, particularly in the ones that were distressed, where we would have not just daily, but sometimes two and three times a daily liquidity calls. We'd have people down on the desks watching what's going on, you know, trying to sort through all that.
Hey, this is September or the summer, right?
No, not so much the summer. It was more from September on. Some companies you know, started having big problems.
When you say September, what year are you talking?
2008.
Okay.
Although I would say from 2007. I mean, I think of the crisis as starting in August of 2007. And there was a clear line where we started having problems in the funding the commercial paper market, and things weren't rolling over. From that point forward, we were having much more significant concerns and spending many more examiner resources on liquidity and things related to liquidity, and it gradually got worse. I would say, though, a couple of things. One is the banks at that, from summer 2007 up through the fall of 2008, were holding up much better than the non-banks.
Right.
And, you know, we're viewed much more as much more stable institutions that could play a role in helping out in the crisis. So I know we aren't, you know, we may not get to it, but I mean, when Bank of America bought Countrywide, it was because a stronger company could buy a weaker company, and they were stronger. They had this, you know, phenomenal funding base, et cetera. But you know, the Bear Stearns piece, the liquidity piece, the SIP piece, all that stuff, for the most part, but not completely, was happening outside the U.S. banking system. The U.S. banks were being a source of strength. But eventually, when you had the just, and it's hard to talk about these things without talking about what was happening actually in September, and those, that series of intensifying events that were happening quicker and quicker, and the whole feeling of market confidence more generally, how much that changed the atmosphere for banks. That happened with unbelievable suddenness and violence.
And given that that did happen with unbelievable suddenness, is there now, does the OCC now do anything differently? And in particular, I'm sort of thinking of, you know, the banks that, whether it's a big bank with wholesale funding or whether it's a big bank with a holding company that's a fairly substantial portion of the consolidated entity other than the bank with the wholesale funding structure, since we have seen all these cases where, oh, we're in trouble, we want to shove assets into the insured institution so that we can have a stable source of funding, whether it's the discount window or something else. About how do you guys now evaluate anything differently in terms of the funding at the holding company?
Well, that, yeah, okay, so obviously we are more focused on the bank, the and the Fed does looks more at the holding company level, and we work with them, but the primary responsibility for the holding company funding is with them. I will say what's happened at the bank level is, it's happened, started during the crisis, but continued afterwards, we've required them to hold much higher levels of liquidity, I mean, you know, much higher. And number one. And number two, I think the other thing that it really spawned was an appreciation that we had a pretty good, certainly not perfect, a pretty good common metric for capital, and we never had a very good common metric for liquidity. And it's part that's because liquidity by its nature can be much more idiosyncratic with different institution profiles and how they do what they do. Nevertheless, we strongly supported the effort that's being undertaken by the Basel Committee to come up with a common metric. That has been difficult, and I still think is more in its early stages. I think there's going to be a big iterative process once this thing comes out to get it right, because we just haven't been doing it for as long. So I think that is one of the other responses. One is to hold more liquidity, to be much more conscious of liquidity, but the second piece of it is, and having higher quality liquidity, but the second piece of it is to come up with better measurements. We had done some of that already ourselves in the crisis, but the effort now is to come up with something that works across the industry, and that's worthwhile effort. I believe it'll take some time to perfect, but progress is being made.
Okay, let's turn to Wachovia. And I want you to sort of just generally take me through what was going on in, but let me tell you what we do know to try to shorten it up.
Okay.
From talking to other folks and looking at the documents, of course, you know, we know about the Golden West acquisition and that payment option arm book appears to be the primary driver of the losses and then the loss of confidence in the institution. And, of course, we know about the $9 billion ballpark consolidated net loss report, I think it was on July 22nd of 2008. And then, of course, followed by the GSEs being put down over Labor Day weekend, followed by Lehman failing, followed by AIG being bailed out, followed by WaMu going down on the 25th. But with all of that, I mean, at least what we've seen in terms of the liquidity reports produced by Wachovia and maybe you guys in the Fed, and in talking to folks that were working in that area, it looks like there really wasn't anything that was unmanageable from a liquidity standpoint until that Friday after WaMu was put down on Thursday the 25th, and of course the financial press, and I think even some of the systemic risk exception memos written by the Richmond Fed and the FDIC attributed to, at least in part, the fact that debt holders at the thrift level of WaMu, you know, took hits when WaMu went down. And so I guess, you know, my first question would be, is that consistent with your recollection in terms of the unmanageable liquidity problems of Wachovia that didn't occur until that Friday?
Well, I guess the only little piece I would take on the issue is we were starting to hear that counterparties were getting nervous before then. But we still didn't think, and enough so that we started running scenarios about how much liquidity they have, what would it take, what could they withstand if they, you know, in a normal circumstance, in a distressed circumstance, in a severely distressed stance, based on historical metrics, not based on what we were looking at and the kind of crisis that we were having. So I think there were indications from the company about counterparty problems and people starting to turn the other way. But it hadn't manifested itself in a serious liquidity run until that Friday. I think that is accurate.
And then in terms of, you know, hearing from the company that there were counterparty problems before September 26th, how much before September 26th?
Honestly, I mean,
days, weeks, months.
Days, no, and maybe more than a week. I don't know.
Okay.
But it was. It came up. I'll tell you how it started coming up. And they, first of all, there was one particular problem, which was I couldn't talk to the CEO because he was too recently at the Treasury Department, and he had a one-year cooling-off prohibition. So for me personally, I didn't have the same direct contact with the head of the organization as I normally would. I mean, we weren't talking anymore.
So let me stop. So who was talking to Bob Steele?
So the Fed could. Okay. He could talk to the Fed. And through intermediaries, he could talk to us. But our examiners could not talk to him. He had to excuse himself from a meeting whenever anybody from the OCC showed up. And they looked really hard at getting a waiver, and they never did. They never got one. And that was too bad because, in fact, I know Bob and worked with him, and it would have been helpful to get some color on this. But what I started to say was, we certainly knew that they had issues, and people were perceiving them as having issues as being because of the publicity around thrift assets and what they had. And then that really intensified in August and September, when they were very visibly on the auction block or on the merger block as a potential merger partner with Goldman Sachs and particularly Morgan Stanley, but others. And while that wasn't confirmed in the press, everybody, rumors were abounding, we knew that stuff was going on. And I really think that having put themselves out there and then being rejected, and with the due diligence that was being done on those transactions, all of that was like putting gasoline on what had been some, as you said, manageable thoughts, and ramped up in that crisis period the crisis of confidence to unbelievable levels, and caused them to get to the point where they thought, we weren't sure about this, for them to get to the thought that they couldn't last a week if problems happen. And, you know, the last thing we wanted with an institution this size is to have to do something midweek, which we had to do with WaMu, of course. And it was that concern expressed by them, which we eventually came around to, as a regulatory community that convinced us we needed to do something on the weekend. Even though we, the OCC, felt quite strongly that the losses were that we'd heard people talking about were greatly exaggerated, and the company was not a solvency risk, had a very strong deposit franchise. The losses on the commercial banking side, just we couldn't get there, and even if we looked at the loss numbers on the thrift at levels that WaMu and Countrywide had marked their similar portfolios, that we just couldn't get anywhere near anything that would cause a true solvency problem with the company.
Who was contacting you?
About what?
Well, you said the company contacted us about liquidity issues.
I couldn't.
Okay.
And the CEO couldn't talk directly to us, but their staff was, our staffs are on site. They were talking to them constantly, okay, their senior staff, about how are you seeing things, what things you're looking at. Now, I will say that my senior staff, IESC, and our system, IESC, has a lot of authority. Mm-hmm. He never got a communication directly from them that they didn't think they would be able to last through the subsequent week.
Well, we talked to somebody, and that was, I said, do you think you would make it? And they said, no, we didn't think
that. And I first heard that that Friday, Thursday night, actually, of the WaMu, when I first got wind that they were really talking that thought. It was clearly coming from the most senior positions in the bank. And they were communicating it to the Fed officials that they could talk to, and the Fed officials were communicating it to me. Yeah. That's my recollection.
And I think we've heard, and frankly it may have even been from other OCC people that we've talked to, I'm starting to lose track, that the call came from Steele. I thought Friday, but it might have been Thursday night.
Could have been.
Not to the OCC.
But that's why I said I'm losing. It may have been person. It may have been somebody else.
I'm pretty sure it was Thursday night. Again, I'll tell you why. Because I was at an international banking supervisory conference. Well, it could have been Friday. I'm trying to remember, because WaMu was Thursday night,
right?
And we did that, and then I flew home on Friday and Saturday morning, thinking, well, we got rid of that one, that's fine. And then during the day, Friday was when I started getting the calls, and then hearing that they were. That's right, it was Friday. I don't think it was Thursday night.
Okay. But we've also heard that while Friday is, that the liquidity crisis didn't occur until Friday, we've also heard, for whatever reason, didn't start occurring until after lunch. Apparently the market took a few hours.
My recollection is that people were even saying in the morning that they thought the WaMu thing that would be sort of a non-event, they'd be able to, withhold it, but
I know
that was more
just to be clear, the call was from Jane Sherburne and the new CFO, David Swiner,
David Swiner?
CFO.
Oh, CFO. Thank you.
CFO David Swiner on Friday the 26th.
But
and that call was too?
That was with Doug Roeder and Julie Williams.
Okay, that's right. That's what I heard earlier this week, I think. Okay, so I know WaMu was not an OCC institution.
Right.
Were you guys involved at all in the decision?
I was on board the FDIC.
Of course. Was there consideration about doing a systemic risk exception for WaMu?
Yes, but, once you had a buyer in hand that was willing to do the deal the other way, these are all judgment calls, and we were kept getting progressively bigger in the institutions that we were willing to take down at the risk of, with haircuts, at the risk of causing problem. They happened to be a firm that had a lot of subordination, which meant that all depositors, would get fully protected. And that it would be non-depositors that would absorb the loss. And that would give us some comfort that if it was truly non-depositors and really a subordinated creditors, the longer-term creditors than that, that it might not create the same kind of funding problems. Now, that was particularly also true because they were not a particularly complex bank. They were complex in terms of the mortgages they had, but in terms of they didn't have a significant derivatives book. and the other kinds of systemic interconnections that would make them as difficult as a more complicated company. Even so, there were people who were quite nervous about it. And we knew we were taking a little bit of a risk in doing it that way as to what kind of signal it would send at that particular moment in the crisis.
And let me ask you a little bit about that, because as I said earlier, you know, we've seen the FDIC memo on recommending invocation of the systemic risk exception for Wachovia and the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond memo. And of course, we've seen the transcript of the board meeting you guys had at 6:30 in the morning on November the 29th, I'm sure. And I hear you talking about subordination so that, you know, depositors would be protected and that the debt holders would take the loss. But, of course, that was, from what I've seen in the memo,